Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. Our weekly look at our food system, food, and the environment. Reminding you on the way to the conversation, support for The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn all about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org, or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner on our page. We begin our Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites this week talking about hunger. We've talked about that a lot, food insecurity. There's one report that we read. You can take any one of these two numbers. Either number is huge. That 4.8 million to 6 million senior citizens, people 65 and over in the United States of America, are food insecure. Eat dog food, eat cat food, stretch money out, having a difficult time to live. We'll hear some of those voices from the AARP video that was done on this. We'll hear a few clips from that, but I want to introduce our guest first. We're here with Michael J. Wilson, who's director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. Good to have you back in the studio again, Michael.
Mark, glad to be back.
And we are here with Shelley White, who's joins by phone, program director for Real Food Farm. Shelley, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, too.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner or log on to our Facebook pages. So let me, from this macro perspective here in the state, talk a bit about, Michael Wilson, what this means in Maryland.
Well, in Maryland, nearly one of every four seniors, 65 and over, are likely to be eligible for FSP, also known as SNAP, because they have incomes at or below 200% of the federal poverty.
25% of seniors. How many people are we talking about here?
So, you know, we're talking about, you know, I don't know the exact number, but that's, you know, it's a big number of people. So, as sometimes when I'm in Annapolis, we hear people worried about people who won't be able to pass on a lot of money to their heirs, and they want to change the tax system. They're really talking about a small percentage, and we're talking about nearly a quarter of seniors in the state of Maryland are likely to be eligible for food stamps, and that's a big number. And as we know, you know, we talk about what food means to all of us, not just as a social thing, but something that you need. It's particularly important for seniors because food is, we can talk about a food like medicine. If you don't have enough food, your medicine doesn't work as well. If you don't have enough food, your health isn't going to be nearly as good. And this is it's a real challenge. So we're really worried about that, which is why we talk about February also being Senior Hunger Action Month. We really try to focus on it in the month of February.
That's right. I forgot that was this month. But that, yeah.
That's right.
Everything has this month.
That's right.
Sometimes people have to share a month. But
yeah.
Shelley White, I'm curious what you discover in your food distribution. What have you seen that has kind of taken you aback about all this?
I'm not so sure if taken aback is quite the right phraseology there. We work in a lot of low-income neighborhoods, so we come to expect, you know, folks using a lot of EBT and food assistance benefits. We actually try to cater our mobile market so that it's easier for folks to use that. With specific to seniors, we visit a lot of either senior centers or senior residential complexes. I'm trying to target that population knowing that, A, they come from a culture or a history of having access to fresh vegetables that we want to continue, but also, B, that access is a huge issue with them, you know, transportation to the grocery store, even just having that fresh vegetable available to them can be difficult. So we use our mobile market to bring that food right to them. And we definitely do see a spike with the food assistance benefits, whether it's EBT or Farmers Market Nutrition Program, which also has vouchers for seniors. We do see a spike when those become available for the seniors, especially towards the end of the season, right before they expire. Folks are very eager to get their food. It expires, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it expires right before the Thanksgiving holiday or right around the Thanksgiving holiday. So folks really take advantage of that so that they can have that traditional feast with fresh produce right from the farm.
But so let's go, Michael.
Sure.
Let me come back to you and just talk a bit about...
Let's talk a little bit about what the senior population is like and the challenges that they have. I mean, I appreciate the work of the mobile markets. It's a partial answer to a big problem. I mean, the challenge is that increases in food insecurity are really reflected because of poverty. And so we have a lot of seniors and a lot of retirees who are in poverty. And so they're not likely to be able to go out and get a job and be able to change their situation. And so, food nutrition programs like FSP, like the mobile markets, are critical for them to be able to survive. We look at disability, which is a much higher rate for seniors. It's very higher amongst those who are seniors. And then we have homelessness. Nationwide, 6% of the entire homeless population is aged 55 to 64. And so these are folks who've had a hard time for a variety of reasons, but now they're dealing with homelessness in addition to their age. So their nutritional needs are really going to be really hard to meet. And the number of homeless elders have 50 plus has grown over the past few years. It's a growing population.
You think about how close people are to the edge all the time.
Right.
In America, many people are close to the edge all the time financially. But when you're a senior citizen, if you're 55 or older or 65 or older and you've lost your job, it's very hard to get a job back. That age.
That's exactly right. So the age discrimination that people find is rampant.
And so and you can't replace that income. And many people, like I was saying to you earlier, I said if something should happen here and all of a sudden this thing I'm doing here on the air should go away, what do I have? 3 months, 6 months, maybe more if I'm lucky, money stashed away, a little kind of other money coming in. But then you're really tight, and then you're up against the wall.
That's exactly right.
And I think that's how close I think the majority of seniors are in America to falling off the edge.
Right. And so one of the underreported parts of the Great Recession is folks who are 45 and older who have faced job discrimination because of their age and have lost a job and can't find another one. And so they're spending their retirement income pre-retirement, which is going to make their post-retirement years even more difficult. And so we're here talking about hunger, but it really has to do with poverty and has to do with employment and people's inability to be able to sustain themselves economically, much less be able to sustain themselves nutritionally.
And before we hear this clip, Shelley, do you want to jump in on that?
No, I just wanted to touch one thing that Michael said about it being a partial answer, and he's absolutely correct. What we do, and we recognize that it's one step to try to fix the food environment in Baltimore City, and it's not by any means fixing the holistic picture of food insecurity or food access as a whole. But we're trying to use the farm as kind of as a leveraging it to bring food to people who can get it, to people that we can reach. So just wanted to touch on that. Partial answer, absolutely correct. Pretty important partial answer as well.
Right. So I want to salute the work that they do at Real Food Farms. I mean, it makes a tremendous difference to everybody who's able to utilize their systems and get that food. And so, Shelley, I mean, we appreciate everything you do so much. But I think you and I are one mind on this, which is that we need a bigger systemic change in order to be able to deal with this problem.
Indeed.
Let me play this clip. This is the clip we were talking. This is a clip about food and seniors and tough choices they have to make from the AARP video.
I can live very cheaply, a lot cheaper than a lot of people. I can buy the already made up Salisbury steak for 88 cents, and it has corn gravy, potatoes in it. You have a meal right there for 88 cents. I keep 3 or 4 of those in the icebox all the time.
Wondering, how far you can stretch a can of tuna, or looking at the apple and thinking it looks really good over rice. Big chunks of meat, I don't know. I've ate cat food before, dry and canned.
So, I mean, this is two of the voices. We could have played a number of voices from this video that run a spectrum. Other people saying how I live on Social Security at $900 a month, and that's all I have right now left because they've you know, our pension was taken away. It no longer exists. We thought we had a pension. The company folded. No pension. I live on what I have in Social Security. So that's reality.
Yes. Yeah, it's a sad fact. I mean, people joke about people who eat cat food and dog food as if that was something that was really funny. But the people who are living with that reality, it's not humorous at all. Most of us think that people should be able to live on food, but not on pet food. And for people to have to reach that level is a distressing situation.
I wonder when you think about what our response to this is. I mean, so Shelley, talk a bit about your response on Real Food Farms. What is our response as a community to all of this?
I have to apologize because I didn't get to hear that clip. I'm not sure if it was.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll tell you what the clip said. The clip was a clip of a man talking about how he can live on very little. He can get a Salisbury steak and kind of a TV dinner for like 88 cents a piece, and he lives on that for a while. The other woman, a woman came on saying, well, the meat in Alpo looks pretty good, and I've had Alpo over rice, and I've eaten cat food before just to make ends meet. So I was saying, so what is our community response to all this?
Right. I think a bigger response is just the shock value of, you know, that is what our food industry has come down to, that is what is affordable to some people, is really just amazing. And that's not, I mean, obviously here at Real Food Farm, we believe in the value of the food and that prices need to reflect what actually goes into growing produce and growing food. But at the same time, you can't have a food environment that is making, you know, the cheapest available foods have such low nutrition content and just such detrimental health values for individuals. And I think it's something that we talk about a lot as part of Civic Works, you know, our parent organization, as part of the community organizations that we work with who are concerned about food security, you know, what role we can play, what role can the greater community play to, you know, make healthy food more available, more accessible, and obviously price is a huge issue in that, and how we can work with the existing programs to make it affordable for individuals. And fortunately, from our standpoint, there are a lot of organizations out there who want to support healthy produce going to individuals to combat, you know, having to buy Alpo or cheap Salisbury steaks from corner stores or wherever they're buying them from, and they really help us, you know, kind of keep our prices down while still supporting the farmer, but making it available to folks that they do have an option other than what was said.
And just very quickly, Michael, before we have to roll into our next segment, I'm curious what you think, what policy decisions can be made, even on the state level, that can change this, that can alter this?
So at the state level, I mean, Maryland did a good job last year when there were rescissions in Meals on Wheels. The federal level, they cut back. Maryland stepped in and helped to fund that so people who otherwise wouldn't get a chance to get meals were able to get them. And so we've done some things here at the state level, but we can't ignore the federal level here. I mean,
right.
What they've done in terms of reductions in food stamp the last two things that they've done, both the ERA cuts and the
right.
Heat and Eat cut that they made in the Farm Bill were not helpful to seniors or to anybody else who's hungry in this country. If I can just say two things real quickly. We do outreach events with AARP, which is phenomenal, in order to reach directly to seniors, to be able to get people to sign up for FSP where they can, and to provide free outreach materials to other organizations and other associations. And, you know, we do training of other organizations to do outreach as well. We want to make sure we can reach as many folks as possible, and that's one of the reasons why we have Senior Hunger Action Month, and we're able to come here and
so
talk
So very
about
quickly, because we do have to roll here. So how do people get in touch?
They can reach us online at MarylandHungerSolutions.org, or they can call us at 410-528-0021.
And that'll be on our website. I want to thank Michael J. Wilson, Director of Maryland Hunger Solutions, and Shelley White, Program Coordinator for Real Food Farm, for joining us for Sound Bites here. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll remind you that the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com, or go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. Last Thursday, my producer, Stephanie Mavronis, covered the Stop Cove Point rally that was held in downtown Baltimore. Hundreds of people gathered at the War Memorial Plaza. While inside a building on the plaza, Dominion Energy, the energy group that wants to build the liquefied natural gas export facility in Cove Point, met there about an essential permit it needs from the Maryland Public Service Commission to start building its $3.8 billion facility in Southern Maryland. Now, we'll hear from Dominion Energy in just a few minutes. But first, here's producer Stephanie Mavronis.
The turnout at last Thursday's Stop Cove Point march and rally was impressive, especially when you think about all of the people in attendance who traveled from Western Maryland, Southern Maryland, Pennsylvania, and beyond. Even more so when you consider the rally took place at noon on a weekday. Chesapeake Climate Action Network organized the event, and I talked to John Kenny, who's their Southern Maryland organizer.
Hundreds of people have gathered from Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, New York, New Jersey to stop Cove Point, which is a natural gas export facility on the Chesapeake Bay. If that gets built, it would be detrimental for the bay. It'd be bad for global warming. It would be bad for it would increase fracking, and it would pollute the air and water. There's a lot of local impacts it would have, so increased tanker traffic in the bay. Those tankers are going to dump millions of gallons of ballast water. That could have invasive species and other sort of detrimental effects on the bay. Lots of air pollution, so like toxic pollutants like smog forming pollutants, and then also methane and just sort of global warming pollution. And then you have to just frack that gas to get it to go out of Cove Point. And so all the detrimental effects of fracking, plus piping, and then liquefying, and then transporting to across the world to other countries, and then combusting and burning in other countries creates an enormous amount of global warming pollution. People realize that this is a really big deal. This is definitely, if this gets built, will be the largest LNG export facility in the entire country. And it just means it incentivizes fracking to an extent where, I mean, obviously people from Pennsylvania who are dealing with fracking are coming all the way here to stop this thing from happening. It just means that people understand that it's all connected and want to stop it.
Jeanette Berman, also with Chesapeake Climate Action Network, talked to me while holding a mock 100-foot-long Stop Cove Point gas pipeline.
Everyone's out here today to march to the Public Service Commission and also Cardin and Mikulski's Baltimore offices to demand them to stop with Cove Point liquid natural gas export facility plant that's proposed to be constructed along the Chesapeake Bay before an environmental impact assessment has been done. Would sort of catalyze the exploration of more hydraulic fracturing in the Maryland area. So this is kind of like Dominion's leverage. If they get the okay with this, then there's going to be further exploration that could eventually lead to fracking Maryland.
Gubernatorial candidate Delegate Heather Mazier spoke at the rally, calling on Governor Martin O'Malley to end his silence on Cove Point and reject the project. Here's Delegate Mazier.
Maryland has 3,000 miles of coastline, and this proposed project would have an impact on rising pollution, rising prices, and rising tides. And when we saw with Sandy a 5-foot storm surge nearly crushed Crisfield on the eastern shore, we have to make sure that we take strong stands. You cannot say that you want to address climate change and be in favor of this Cove Point project. It would make Maryland an international sacrifice zone for all the fracked gas coming from every other state, coming through our state, to be shipped out. And for that to happen, we would have more fracked wells, we would have compressor stations, pipelines, liquefiers, and more tanker traffic in the Chesapeake Bay, all leading to disastrous environmental consequences. We have to take a hardline stand here and reject this project altogether. Even the Department of Energy at the federal level, when they did their economic analysis study, they showed that every single sector in our nation's economy would be negatively impacted by the extraction and liquefaction and export of natural gas. Every single sector of the economy, except, you guessed it, the oil and gas companies. And so they have a lot of financial incentives at stake to make sure that they continue to sell their version of this story, but it's just not aligned with the facts. If you look at the size of the crowd in the middle of the day on a weekday, the homemade signs, the amount of energy and enthusiasm behind making sure we address these issues, Maryland is fired up about a range of environmental causes, and we're we're done with the silence of political leadership that won't take the right stance on these issues, and we're done with the oil and gas industry having its way in this state. We're standing up to say that there is a different future ahead of us in Maryland, one where we are not fracking and where there is no LNG export facility, and we are taking these hard stands and saying this is how Maryland's future will be.
Food and Water Watch was one of the organizations taking a stand against Cove Point. Here's Emily Wirth, Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director.
Well, we oppose the Cove Point LNG export facility because we know it will put pressure to increase drilling and fracking not only in the state of Maryland but in the surrounding regions of Virginia, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, New Jersey, New York, potentially with the infrastructure associated with this. And we are very serious concerns about the inherent dangers associated with drilling and fracking. The Public Services Commission is meeting just several blocks away. We just marched right past that, and they are making important decisions about some of the permits that Dominion, the company, needs to move forward with the facility. And so we're calling on them to recognize that this facility is not in the public interest for Marylanders and that they should not approve those permits. We're also calling on the FERC and the Obama administration to do a complete environmental impact assessment of all of the dangers associated with this facility, to look at the broader impacts of the increased drilling and fracking that would be happening. And instead, they've done an environmental assessment that does not include those broader impacts.
Those opposed to the Cove Point liquefied natural gas facility understood its regional significance and the impact an export facility in Maryland would have on the fracking operations already present in other states. Here's Elizabeth Arnold, who traveled to Baltimore from Pennsylvania.
I'm here because in Pennsylvania, our ability to live in Pennsylvania is being threatened, and there are people living without clean drinking water, where our natural places are, you know, no longer being places that you can hike and just, you know, put some iodine tablets in the water and keep camping and hiking and enjoying the outdoors. And in the cities, we're facing infrastructure projects and fracked oil trains from North Dakota and fracked gas pipelines, which are really, really dangerous. I mean, we had an explosion just a couple weeks ago in western Pennsylvania where a 27-year-old gas worker was killed and so badly burned they only found some of his bones. And this is not, like, these aren't the kind of jobs that we want. This isn't the kind of world we want to live in. And Pennsylvania's already lived through the boom-bust cycle of coal. We don't want to just have another boom-bust of natural gas. If Cove Point gets retrofitted to export liquid natural gas, we are screwed in Pennsylvania. We will not be able to effectively fight this as well as we could if there wasn't an increased demand. Our lives depend on it in Pennsylvania, and we're counting on you.
Nadine Block, who was holding a sign in the massive crowd, summed up why so many people turned out last week in downtown Baltimore.
This is critical because we are fighting both globally and locally for a saner future and a saner energy policy, and we need to take this opportunity to fight right here where we live in Maryland and stop fossil fuel development in its tracks.
For the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, I'm Stephanie Mavronis.
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. There's more on the proposed Cove Point LNG, or the Liquid Natural Gas Export Facility, right after this break. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. We just heard from people advocating against the LNG facility at last week's Stop Cove Point rally that was held in downtown Baltimore. Now we're going to hear how Dominion Energy responds to those concerns. We're now about to talk with Pam Faggert, who was Dominion Energy's chief environmental officer. And Pam Faggert, welcome. Good to have you here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. So let me begin just to talk a bit about this plant that Dominion is proposing, and just from your perspective, I mean, why Dominion is building this here and why they think it needs to happen.
Thanks for inviting me on the show, Mark. I'd like to start by saying, first of all, I think I have the best job at Dominion. The environment is my passion, both personally and professionally. Because of that, I'm acutely aware that producing and transporting life essentials like electricity and natural gas is never free and never without impact to our world, and the key is finding the right balance. And, you know, Dominion is finding that right balance. Along with traditional electric power generation and natural gas business, we own solar facilities in 3 states, wind farms in 2. We have a green power program in our home state of Virginia. And more than 20,000 of our customers belong to the green power program. And we recently just announced that we will participate in the federal bidding process for wind generation off the coast of Maryland, just as we successfully bid in Virginia. With regard to our project, the project is to add natural gas export capabilities at our Cove Point facility in Calvert County, and that project is based on such a balance. You asked why, and the reason why is we already have an existing facility at Cove Point. The facility's been there about 40 years, and, you know, right now it's an import facility. You know, as you know, the import business for natural gas isn't very good right now because we produce plentiful, cost-effective natural gas right here in the United States. So what we're doing is turning it around to make it an export facility.
Now that you brought that up, let me just ask this question. There have been some studies that we've seen from the DOE, Department of Energy, and other places, from some other business leaders who question what this export of gas will mean for the United States, that it's actually going to mean higher prices in America. It actually is going to mean fewer jobs that pay less money than before if we base this all on export. And this is coming not just from environmentalists who think that this is a bad idea and that gas is a bad idea, but from business and the government who say only the companies that export it are you making a profit. It's going to do little for anybody else.
My responsibility is the environmental responsibility at Dominion. And if you look at this thing holistically, we're providing natural gas to our customers who might otherwise use more polluting fuels. For example, it's very possible that absent having available and cost-effective natural gas, they would have coal. So from an environmental perspective, it's a better outcome environmentally.
But you can't comment on the other part. I mean, that may be true on some levels, but in the long run, what will this do for the American economy is another question.
Well, there have been many studies, and, you know, what those studies have shown is that there would be very minimal price increases, if any at all, because we do have plentiful supplies of natural gas to use right here in the United States.
One of the critics for Cove Point said that the Cove Point LNG facility would emit more gas, carbon dioxide, than all the industries combined around here, 3.3 million tons, which would make it the state's dirtiest. And they're saying that's because of the process of chilling natural gas at 270 degrees below zero, that it requires that much energy to do. So that actually it will have a negative impact in that sense on climate change, at least on our shores, than it would otherwise.
Let's first start with the number you threw out there, 3 million tons a year. That number, I believe, when folks throw it out, is taking the emissions that would come from importing natural gas and adding them to the emissions that would come from exporting natural gas. And it just would not make economic sense to import natural gas and export natural gas at the same time. So although we have a contractual requirements to both be able to import and export natural gas, realistically, we won't be doing it at the same time. So it's not realistic to say that our emissions will be that high.
But they will be high.
Our facility is actually, we believe, the most efficient design for facilities of its type, and that's because of the way we've designed the process. You know, our view is that for an LNG export facility, it'll be the most efficient, including the most low-emitting facility of its type.
When you hear the other perspectives in this broadcast, one of the things people are going to be saying is that the whole idea, when we talk about the environment, that extraction, transport of natural gas, and the rest, can they ever truly be thought of as environmentally friendly or sustainable? Isn't it, in some ways, the antithesis of all that?
We continue to grow our demand for energy use here in the United States, and so do other countries, and we need to be able to satisfy that demand. And the question is how to do that in an environmentally friendly way, while at the same time providing an affordable energy source for consumers. And if you look at the choices, you have renewable energy, you have coal, and Dominion and other companies are starting to use less coal than we have in the past, and now natural gas. And the emissions from natural gas are about half of that you would have as if you're combusting coal. You know, you don't just look at what the emissions are from combusting natural gas, or in our case, you know, exporting natural gas. You have to look at the alternatives. What would the emissions be under an alternative scenario?
What about when you add in the controversy over how we drill the gas in America? I know that's a huge controversy at the moment on hydraulic fracking, what that does to the environment or what it doesn't do to the environment. How do you take that into account?
We do believe that a lot of folks that are protesting against our facility are, in fact, expressing their concern about things that have nothing to do with activities that will go on at our facility. You know, our project will be to liquefy natural gas and export it. The concerns we're hearing, in fact, have to do with the production of natural gas. which is not what we're seeking regulatory approvals for.
But can you separate the two?
Well, I think so. I mean, our project is to export the natural gas. The production of natural gas is heavily regulated, but that is done by other companies and, you know, is appropriately taken up in the regulatory proceedings, you know, for those activities.
I mean, the industries are kind of connected both in terms of the need for one another and also just connected corporately. I mean, they're not separate from one another.
I think I understand what you're saying. You know, we can't transport or export natural gas if somebody doesn't produce it. We are absolutely not saying that the production of natural gas should not be regulated. It is regulated, and we agree it should be regulated. What we're saying, though, is that is not the subject of this regulatory proceeding.
Again, guys, I'm asking these questions is because one of the things we hear other people saying, I mean, is that if we do this, have the Cove Point facility, then that in itself would lead to the demand of more fracking of gas.
Our view is that natural gas is going to be exported from the United States. Really, the only question is whether it'll be exported from the Cove Point facility or exported from other facilities. There's really quite a few facilities that are somewhere in the process of getting their approval, either from DOE or, like us, from FERC. Our view is there will be natural gas exported. The only question is what facility will export it. So it's not a question of stopping natural gas export or natural gas production. The only question is whether it'll be from Cove Point or from somewhere else.
When people who live in the area, some people live in the area, and environmentalists say the facility would mean that like 91,000-foot-long tankers would be pumping up and down the Chesapeake Bay every year, that besides the pollution they're saying that could take place, is that this is explosively, dangerously explosive liquid fuel that we could have all kinds of spills. I mean, how do you ameliorate that to the in the public's eye?
Our facility has been there approximately 40 years. We were an import facility for all of that time. We have an excellent safety record at that facility, and we are going to maintain that safety record going forward as we switch from being entirely import to being primarily export. You know, one of the advantages of our facility is it is an existing facility. We already have the docks. We already have the authorization for the ship traffic. You know, we're not asking for approval for more ships to come than we already have the approvals for. The facility will be built entirely within the footprint of the existing facility. We'll continue to maintain the protected areas outside of the fence. You know, the fact that it's being built at an existing facility, the fact that we're building entirely on the footprint of the current industrial area, the fact that we're not asking for permission for more ship traffic than we currently have, the fact that we don't have to build a new pier. We already have the piers necessary to support this project. We think makes this project the right one for this project.
Well, Pam Faggert, I really appreciate you taking time. Pam Faggert, as I said earlier, is Dominion Energy's Chief Environmental Officer. We deeply appreciate you taking the time here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
You're certainly welcome, Mark.
There's an opportunity for the public to comment on the Cove Point project this Saturday, March the 1st, in Calvert County. For information on that, please visit steinershow.org or chesapeakeclimate.org. We're about to talk about the Poultry Fair Share Act, which would force large poultry companies like Perdue, Tyson, Mount Air, to pay a 5-cent per bird tax towards the cleanup of phosphorus that runs off into the bay. And first up, we have Delegate Shane Robinson of Montgomery County. He was the sponsor of the Poultry Fair Share Act in the House, but withdrew it after Governor Martin O'Malley promised to veto it. Tell me first, before we talk about why it was withdrawn, talk about why you introduced it in the first place.
Well, I introduced it because we have a serious phosphorus pollution problem in the bay and the bay watershed. Of the three limits that we're trying to reach for nitrogen levels, sediment levels, and phosphorus, we've made a lot of headway with nitrogen and sediment, and it looks like we're going to get to the EPA-mandated limits, but we're probably not going to make it with phosphorus. We're looking at ways to get there, and in my view, it's unfair that corporations can be let off the hook for phosphorus pollution that their property is creating, in this case, the corporations that own the birds. So those costs are passed on to farmers, and this bill was intended to start a conversation to look at how we might be able to change that system so that we have the corporations working with us to decrease phosphorus rather than just passing costs on to farmers and then potentially consumers.
Now, there's a lot of argument around this, and part of that has to do with the question of who actually should be paying, and this is a, in some ways, a new concept. I mean, because it was this lawsuit that failed that was going with one farmer and Perdue that happened last year, as we all know about.
Right.
And so that's where the first the thought came up that I can remember in public discussion that groups like Perdue and Tyson should actually pay because they literally own the chickens, even though the farmers are raising the chickens for them and control the chickens to a certain point. I mean, talk a bit about during the process of how we raise our chickens, where you think this fits in and why.
We're paying the cost, right? So if it's 5 cents a chicken, and that was the number that we got to because we thought it would be something that's manageable. But the cost for cleanup is there. Like any animal, right, is through its diet is then creating nutrients. It's creating waste that ultimately are getting into the bay. You and I pay for our nutrient waste into the Bay Restoration Fund. We're already paying as part of our water bill for that. Chickens are creating waste too, but they're not paying for their part. So, I mean, who should be charged? Obviously, chickens aren't going to foot the bill. So the next step in my mind that's logical is the owner of that chicken. Farmers are getting paid to raise those chickens, but they don't actually own them. So I didn't think that being hired out to raise a chicken, it would be fair for them to be the ones that actually pay for it, that it would make more sense for the owners of those birds to actually help us to mitigate the cost of the phosphorus pollution.
But you withdrew that bill. I know there was a quote by Martin O'Malley, and we talked about this on the air during our Annapolis summit. And the quote was, "The truth of the matter is we're one Maryland. We are all in this together. We cannot survive as a state unless agriculture is profitable in our state," he said.
Right.
I would tell you this, read my lips, if that chicken tax passes, I will veto it. Is that why you withdrew it?
That is why I withdrew it. He was pretty clear on that Thursday evening. So the next day I did withdraw it. You know, I have a lot of other legislation that I'm working on right now. And when it was clear that it wasn't going to go anywhere, I thought the best move was to withdraw it. It did have the effect of starting a conversation. And it let people know that we're serious. And we are. And this is an issue that I want to solve, this problem of how do we mitigate the cost of phosphorus pollution. So it's something that I want to come back to next year and work on with people in the interim. Will it look differently than it did this year? Probably. But we'll be in a new session with a new governor, many new legislators. We'll just have to see what happens.
Now, I'm curious why you and others around you decided not to, though, make the fight with O'Malley on this. Why not kind of go head-to-head as part of the process for those who agree with this, if people do agree with this, to kind of bring it to light and really make it a public battle so maybe it may see light of a day in a stronger way next year if that's what people want. But why did you all decide not to make it a political issue?
You make a good point, and I'm happy that Senator Madaleno has left his in so that we still do get the benefit of having a public bill hearing. I don't think having two would necessarily bring any extra information to light, but it was a difficult decision. It wasn't one that I made lightly. It was my sense that it was the time to pull it out rather than go to head-to-head with the governor, especially because he's been such a great governor in so many regards, and he's really led on a lot of environmental issues. Figured, for now, let sleeping dogs lie. We started the conversation. People know that we're serious, and we'll come back to it in the interim and see if we can't come up with something that has a better chance for next session.
Some people are making the argument that if a bill like the Poultry Fair Share Act passes, that we, as we said earlier, would require the companies who actually own the chickens and then sell them to us later have to pay this 5 cents a head, that if we did that, people are arguing that it would chase these businesses out of Maryland. They would end up going to Arkansas, some other southern state, or South America.
I've heard that argument, too. I think it comes to, you know, what's the straw that broke the camel's back? I don't think this would be it. We're talking a revenue of maybe $12 to $15 million compared to what would likely be a couple of billion dollars to pull up shop and start again somewhere else. But it is a larger problem that we're facing with agriculture in the state of Maryland. And it's an unfortunate one because farmers really are squeezed in this state and across the country because on one hand, people demand cheap food at the checkout line. On the other hand, we have all these fragile ecosystems that we need to protect. And those things go hand in hand. You're not going to have successful agriculture if we have a polluted bay. We have to clean up the bay. But in order to clean up the bay, we need funding. And that, and we also need to implement regulations. And both of those things cut into the profits of farmers. We're really in between a rock and a hard place, and we're going to have to do some serious thinking, not only as a state, but as a nation, about how we're going to address these competing competing goals, one of being cheap food and the other one being a clean environment, because they really are mutually exclusive.
Finally, before you go, what is your sense of what your colleagues are saying about this? I mean, I know that the majority of representatives from the Eastern Shore, Republican and Democrat, oppose this measure. But
they do.
So talk about a bit what you think is the kind of political viability of this. What are your other fellow delegates saying from Montgomery County, Prince George's County, Baltimore City, and around?
The co-sponsors that I did get on the bill before I withdrew it were from around the state, but mostly from the urban and suburban areas. Right, so I didn't have any co-sponsors from the Eastern Shore, which comes as no surprise, because that is where the bulk of the payment would be for this type of initiative. But on the other hand, the rest of us are paying for that as it is right now, and we're going to have to pay for it when we don't hit those mandated pollution limits for phosphorus. So we're all going to have to pay. I mean, as it is now, it's an externality, right? So you're not paying for it when you buy the chicken and eat it, or the farmer's not paying for it directly when they're growing the birds, nor the corporation, but everybody else is going to have to pay for the cleanup. So now it's more like a user fee. So I think most of the support is going to be from the jurisdictions that aren't growing the broilers, and that's just simple economics. You know, and I don't know if that's the right solution. When I say I'm going to bring it back again next year, we're going to come back with another, maybe the same way, but some way to get at dealing with this phosphorus pollution. That's our goal. What we want to do is clean up the phosphorus. I'm not interested in pushing an industry out of Maryland, and I'm not interested in making it harder for a farm family to be able to send their kids to college and put food on the table. What I am interested in is cleaning up the phosphorus pollution and making the bay healthier, because that's going to help us all, and that is, if not the single most important thing that we can do in Maryland from an environmental perspective, it's certainly up there.
Well, Delegate Shane Robinson, who's a Democrat from Montgomery County, I appreciate you taking the time with us this morning here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show, and look forward to talking to you a great deal more in the coming year on this issue.
Thank you very much.
Now we're about to talk to Senator Richard Coburn, who's joined us many times before. He's, of course, a Maryland State Senator representing the 37th District, Caroline, Dorchester, Talbot, and Wicomico counties. Senator Coburn, welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites.
Good to talk to you again, Mark. Again, congratulations on over 20 years of doing what nobody does better.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We've been talking today a bit about the Poultry Fair Share Act, which we know that was removed from the House. We know that Senator Madalino from Montgomery County is still introducing the bill into the state Senate. And we know the governor said if it comes across his desk, he will veto it, as we talked about a little earlier. But I'm really curious to get your sense of this bill. It seems like there's a real divide over this bill geographically in the state as well. Talk about one of the reasons why you think this bill doesn't make sense.
There's many reasons why it doesn't make sense. When you add a 5-cent fee or tax to each chicken produced on the eastern shore of Maryland, you put us at a distinct disadvantage with not only other states like North Carolina, but our major competitors, the two eastern shore of Virginia counties, as well as the two lower counties of the of Delaware. So basically this bill, when you operate at a slim profit margin, that 5 cents would put the Delmarva poultry industry out of business on the eastern shore of Maryland. It's about upwards to about a $2 billion industry, employs about 7,000 people directly and 25,000 indirect jobs. So it would be a major economic disaster if the bill were to pass the Senate, and then if it were to go on through the House, and as you say, Delegate Robinson's withdrawing his bill, and the governor says he will veto the bill. Now, certainly, it takes on a political aspect. Who's the most liberal candidate running for that Senate seat in Montgomery County? Because as we speak, the hearing is still scheduled to take place on February 25th.
The bill clearly will not probably pass this year. If it did, we know the governor would veto it. But the discussion has begun now because of the bill, and we know it'll be reintroduced next year. We don't know who the governor is, and we don't know what the makeup of the new 55 delegates would be who are going to come into the legislature after this year. That could change a lot of the nature of both the House and the Senate. So I'm curious what you think about what this means politically. I mean, about the argument that phosphorus levels are going to go beyond what the EPA says they should be. It has not been able to control that particular point source, and that since Purdue, Tyson, and other companies own the chickens, they should pay a piece. Now, what's the argument against that from your perspective?
The argument is that the money in the Senate Bill 725, the funds would go to a Bay Restoration Fund, cover crop activities. Basically, every farmer that wants to do cover crops, and we'd encourage more, they're doing cover crops. So the money is not necessary. The money is already in the budget. Agriculture, Eastern Shore of Maryland, we've done our fair share. We've exceeded the goals of the EPA and doing their part, their percentage, if you want to say, of cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay. Phosphorus is not a toxic chemical. It's a naturally occurring element in plants and the soil because of putting phosphorus on crops as farmers were told to do. And this change that now the EPA wants phosphorus out of the soil. You can't reverse that overnight. Some say that if you can read the phosphorus level on certain soils on the Eastern Shore today, apply absolutely no phosphorus for 50 years, and the phosphorus level will still be the same 50 years from now as it is today, because phosphorus doesn't go away. It stays there. It stays in the soil.
What do you think would happen there? You talk about there's been onerous on the chicken industry and the agriculture industry, the poultry industry, especially on Delmarva. But what do you think would be the effect of having a 5 cent a head tax devoted just to this particular subject? I'd like to talk a bit more about why you think that would do nothing to help the Bay, and how do you think it would affect Purdue, Tyson's, anybody else's, Mount Airy's bottom line?
Well, as I said, the bottom line is Purdue, Tyson, Mount Air would lose any incentive they have to raise chickens, to produce chickens for the supermarkets. And we know that there's a lot of people in Montgomery and Prince George's County think that chicken just automatically appears on the grocery shelf in a meat cooler, but it doesn't happen that way. They would just produce the chickens in Delaware and Virginia and seek to grow up in other states like North Carolina, because that 5 cents per chicken takes away any profit margin. People aren't going to raise chickens at a deficit, losing money. So again, the money is already there to do what the bill wants to do. The nutrient management plans have been in effect since Chris Van Hollen was in the House of Delegates and introduced legislation for nutrient management plans on the Eastern Shore, another Montgomery County legislator who makes political hay out of introducing bills to help us help ourselves, and we're doing right pretty fine. You know, very little of the water flowing in Chesapeake Bay comes from the Eastern Shore. We get lumped in with poor performing jurisdictions throughout the watershed. You have a lot of sewer overflows right there from the Washington Sanitary Commission that governs the sewage coming from Montgomery and Prince George's County. And that's why I introduced the bill to address that. I introduced the Friday Senate Bill 1071, which would require Prince George and Montgomery counties to create a sewage and sludge remediation charge fund put a fee on East Montgomery and Prince George's County that uses the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission, regulated by that commission, because you know, if you really want to talk about sewage overflows, you look at the Prince George's Montgomery County, what they contribute to bay pollution, and you see a tremendous amount of sewage, you know, being dumped into the Potomac River, and the Potomac River goes into the Chesapeake Bay. So my bill would create a billion-dollar fund because the Washington Suburban Sanitary Commission is under consent order because of their 42,200,000 gallons of sewage spills, an average of 10.5 million gallons per year, 20,800 gallons of sewage dumped into the Potomac every day.
So now your bill, Senate Bill 1071, which is called the Montgomery County and Prince George's County Fair Share Act of 2014.
Here's a title, but...
Where'd you get that title?
Yeah. Senator Madalena did help me out on the title.
So let me ask this quick question about this. This series now is that the way this is, your bill coming in, it seems as if in some ways this you see kind of almost a, one of a better term, I was going to say war. I hate using the word war.
The geographical war between the Eastern Shore and the Western Shore, particularly Prince George's and Montgomery counties.
Yes.
As I said, I was in the House of Delegates from 83 to 90 and in the Senate since 94, and we were constantly barraged every session with legislation introduced from delegates and senators from Prince George's and Montgomery County that want to help us help us. They try to regulate the our two major industries, the agriculture and seafood industry. They're after poachers on the Chesapeake Bay. They're creating sanctuaries in the Chesapeake Bay for oysters. They want us not to catch crabs. And as you say, with Senate Bill 725, they want to tax our chickens. First they want to tax the rain, now they want to tax chickens. But fair is fair. You know, finally, you know, after 28 years, 28 sessions of seeing this type of legislation, it's time that somebody countered it. You could call it tit for tat if you want to. You know, every action has an opposite and equal reaction. If we want to clean up the bay, then we need to stop these Montgomery and Prince George's County sewage and sludge dumpings into the Potomac River.
I'm going to thank you so much once again, Senator Coburn, Richard Coburn from District 37 on the Eastern Shore, Caroline, Dorchester, Talbot, Wicomico counties, for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Thank you, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.